sale of that property. Those of you who remember the Sunday morning before Christmas, remember that I shared with you that the Cottage Grove Baptist Church that owns a small piece of property down on Katy Freeway between here and the city was disbanding. They had about 11 or 12 members left. They joined a small church nearby and had given their property to our church for the purpose of being sold. And there's two pieces of land, and we've sold one of them. And I think the price was about $220,000, $30,000, $40,000 in that range. And the stipulations were that we would handle this for them, and that off of the top, some proceeds would go to Houston Baptist University, and some would go to buy their new church a van, and that what was left would be divided between the two churches, and what is left is about $100,000, and so each of the churches will receive $50,000, and the $50,000 that we're receiving is designated by the donor church for the purpose of helping our work with our Project 65, the 65 little inner city churches that we're working with. And so that $50,000 over the next year or so will go a long way, certainly, as we have a lot of energy and love and time involved in that, but no budget item to help in that. And so we're grateful the Lord has made possible that sale, and this $50,000 that'll end up going through our church to help these struggling churches will certainly mean a lot to them. I wish I could tell you, and I will have Harvey Knozel at some near date, tell you all of the good things that are going on in these churches we're working with. All of these churches have been identified as churches with 6 months to 24 months to survive. One or two of them have become mission centers of our church, and we've gone in there and have started some ethnic ministries. And in every case, they've more than quadrupled in attendance the first few Sundays. One of them, as I referred to you, that was going to disband in a month with 11 members, is now running 90 in Sunday school. And one of them, I understand, last Sunday baptized 33 people. I want to get that straight and give you all that information straight from Harvey's mouth very shortly, but the Lord is certainly blessing that ministry, and we're grateful to the Lord for that. All right, everybody, let's open our Bibles to the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, chapter number 2. We missed last week with the J. Stratt Crusade, and so just to take a minute or two to review, and I promise you it won't be more than 2 minutes, Revelation is the revelation of Jesus, from God to Jesus, to the angel, and to the Lord, to John on Patmos, and to us. It is a book with three divisions. The first chapter is a picture of the historical Jesus in all of his pre-incarnate, present, and eternal work. The second and third chapters are letters to existing churches in Asia Minor that existed then at that time. The last division of the book, chapter 4 to the end, is prophetical about the future, most of it the tribulation, but then the new heaven, the millennial reign, the new heaven, the new earth, and eternity. And so we're studying for some Wednesday nights the second and third chapters, the letters to these churches in Asia Minor. If you were to start to visit them, they would form almost a perfect circle, and they're mostly 30, 40, 50, 75 miles apart. And the church we're going to talk about tonight is about 35 miles from the first church that we looked at last week, the church at Ephesus. And because of a reason or two, I'll suggest to you, it may well be that this second church, the church at Smyrna, began as a mission out of the first church. But the way those churches began is not nearly as intriguing as the manner in which they concluded. And we're going to talk about that at the very end. And I promise you, one of those great a John Wayne heroic type endings, you know, where the hero comes through at the last second. You won't believe the way the story of the Smyrna church ends. It's really, really wonderful. Now, as we reminded you, these seven churches were actual, historical, literal, real churches that were vibrant and alive in those days. There are also pictures of all seven kinds of Christians, of all seven basic types of churches, and beautifully, I think so much inspiration is here, and prophetical ability from our Lord, we also saw, is a picture not only of the seven ages of church history, but of those seven ages sequentially as they actually developed. And we saw that we are living in the closing days, very quickly so, I believe, of the sixth age of church history and the dawning of the last and final one. In every one of these churches, there was a particular need. Note I did not say particular problem. In six of the churches, there was a problem. Isn't that interesting that six out of those seven churches had a specific problem? And I don't know that it's any less true that six out of every seven churches in the world today have some kind of specific problem. And in every one of these, Jesus is addressing a specific need, a specific problem with a specific answer. Now, one of these churches, and because they had a problem, there was a kind of rebuke, at least an exhortation, if not a downright, outright rebuke to each one of them, except in one case, and that's the Smyrna church, the church in verse 8 through 11 of chapter 2, and the message he writes to them, and that's the one we're going to study tonight. Now, Smyrna was the suffering church, and he addresses them not in the area of a problem, but in the area of a need. They were not doing anything wrong. They were doing everything right. They were not suffering. They were not in need because they did something bad and were being judged. They were in need for quite another reason. And it should always be that when the church has need, it is for the right reason, not because of suffering, because of a problem anywhere in the membership or its doctrine or any program. And so we arrive tonight at the study of the only one of the seven churches that bears no rebuke from Jesus, only comfort and encouragement. And the reason he is encouraging and comforting them is very, very important. And I think likely may well be more and more important in the lives of believers as the end approaches. And that is that they were suffering for their testimony of Jesus Christ. I have preached repeatedly and explained why, and will do so again, why I do not believe, though some disagree, and that's fine, but I don't believe that the church is going to go through the tribulation. The purpose of the tribulation is to purge a rebellious, sinful world. God does not pour out his wrath on his own bride. He loves his bride. He protects her. He defends her. He is her lover and advocate and friend and husband and father. He is mad. He is angry at a world system that is diametrically opposed to him. He is purging it that he might come and rule the government on his shoulders in a society that has been purged and made right. The church, when all of this begins, is viewed in chapter 4, verse 1, as having been raptured and long since gone. And from there on, looking down at what's going on earth, not on earth, going through it. That does not say, however, that there will not be some suffering in the church. There's a big difference in saying that the church will not go through the tribulation and in saying, therefore, the church will not suffer. The church will not go through the tribulation, I believe, but I do believe the church will suffer, has suffered, is suffering now in many places in the world and in many degrees in almost every church, and I believe that's going to heat up. In fact, I think that the purpose of the tribulation, of the purpose of the rapture, is that when things heat up so badly and get so difficult that he will remove his bride before he purges and pours his anger out on a sinful world. That's who he's angry at. He's not angry at his bride. But these things do not start and stop on a date. They tend to overlap. And so the animosity that will cause the world in its iniquity and sin to be so rebellious against God that in the tribulation he comes and purges society, that same animosity will be building up as it is today in pre-tribulation times. Therefore, it is perfectly in harmony to say the church will not go through the tribulation, and yet to say the church will suffer. And so when we see suffering by the church, logically, historically, prophetically, experientially, some people deduce that then as saying, therefore, we will go through the tribulation. No, not necessary. Not necessarily so. And so this is a suffering church at Smyrna. And of course, he doesn't purge this suffering church. It's already purged. It's suffering for its testimony for Christ. He's not angry at it. He is commending it. There is no condemnation here, and this is the only one of the six. Does that mean that the only way we can be commended by our Lord and please Him as a church is that we are purged? That is absolutely true. However, the difference is this. It is not necessary for God, by His judgment, to purge us when we purge ourselves. Well, that's critical. Does that mean that the congregation, the pastor, the staff, the deacons, the people, the fellowship, the denomination, the association, churches here and around the world, do have to be purged in order to be clean and purified that they might be blessed? Absolutely yes. But once again, if we purge ourselves, if we confess our own sins, if we in agony do business with our own sins before God, then He doesn't have to purge us. And that's where the blessing comes. This church was certainly being purged and is again the only one of the seven that received no condemnation. I remember hearing about a movie called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Well, chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation are about seven letters to seven brides. The first letter is to Ephesus. It is a cold and backslidden church. 35 miles away, there is another church. And when you understand the excitement and the revival in which that first church at Ephesus was born, you can well imagine that in the hot heat of that revival that gave birth to it, there was a desire to give birth to other churches. And because real evangelism and real fire from God always results in a desire to share. And because all of the world, all of Asia, to them the world, was hearing the gospel and was responding to the gospel, I imagine that they looked to the world extremities to go somewhere else in order to spread the gospel. And to them in those days, I rather imagine 35 miles was a long way away. And so that is pure conjecture. But because of the heat of evangelism and missionary activity likely that came therefrom, from which the church at Ephesus was born before it began to get cold and die, it is quite likely that this first church, the next church nearest to it, the church we'll study tonight at Smyrna, might well have begun as one of its mission churches. And is it not possible that the church next to it began from Smyrna and so on and on? Possibly so. That is certainly, though history doesn't verify it for sure, that is certainly the way we know Christianity has spread. Incidentally, I'm happy to report to you that of all the things that our Foreign Mission Board is doing these days, the number one priority is starting churches around the world. All right? Ephesus began as a red-hot church and soon became cold and dead and backslidden. When Ephesus began, there was tremendous prosperity. They were doing well, but Ephesus got cold and died. Down the road, Smyrna, the church we're looking at now, began and existed in great suffering and persecution, and it survived and lived. Isn't that interesting? And isn't that important? Generally speaking, the worst thing that can happen to the church is prosperity. The church does not grow and expand generally out of prosperity and blessing, but normally out of suffering and persecution. It is estimated that when communism drove Christianity underground and purged it and made it illegal in the mid-40s, when China became communist and closed to the gospel, that there were 3 million believers in China. In the 80s, over 40 years later, when China reopened, what had happened? What had persecution done? What had suffering done to the China church? Had it destroyed it? No. Sure enough, there aren't 3 million there anymore. Now they say there are about 30 to 50 million Christians. And so suffering is God's way of maturing us, and it is God's way of expanding His word and His work. So while Ephesus began in prosperity and blessing and died, Smyrna began in suffering and persecution and lived. Interesting. Verse 8 begins, "Unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write." Now we've seen in chapter 1 and verse 20 who the angel of the church is. That is the word there is angelos. It is sent one. It is a messenger, and it is used interchangeably as pastor. I know that's the first time you ever knew your pastor was an angel, and that's the last time you'll ever hear it or believe it, I'm sure, but that's the one that's being addressed. All right? 150 A.D. to 312 A.D. was approximately the second age of church history. And under the Roman Empire, under the Caesars, that was their word for God, the Russian word czar counterpart, their lords, their gods, Caesar Augustus, Caesar this, Caesar that, there was a tremendous persecution of the church. But here, not in 150, which is generally historically accepted as the dawn of the second age of the church, persecution and suffering under the Caesars, not 150, but 95 or 96 AD, nearly 60 years before that, this church was already suffering. And so if Jesus writes to them in 95 or 96, when we think this was written, this revelation came, and they were already suffering so much that he wrote them to comfort them, then they didn't start suffering the day before. They'd been suffering at least 80, 85, 90. And if you go on through the suffering age of 350, that means for well over 200, maybe 250 years, one congregation had known nothing but misery and sorrow and suffering. And how and why that came about, which we shall see, is tremendously important and encouraging. And so it's important to note that this church was suffering well along before the age of suffering for the church. From whom is the letter written? To the pastor, to the messenger of the church, to the angel, to the suffering church in Smyrna, write these things. Yes? Who says write these things? Write these things, saith, yes, who is saying to write this? The first and the last, which was dead and is alive. Now, let me point out to you something that's very interesting about these letters. You're going to love this. Listen up good. In every one of the seven letters, now let's stop a minute. In Revelation chapter 1, we have a vision of Jesus who was and is to come. In his pre-incarnate state, in his priestly ministry, in his incarnation, in his earthly ministry, in his ministry to the churches, in his death and resurrection, eternality and final world control and eternal victory. An overview of the whole historic who was and is to come, Jesus. That's chapter 1. Now, this is interesting. When you get to chapters 2 and 3, in each one of these church letters to these churches, not only is he dealing with a specific problem, but hear this, he refers back to himself and refers to some part of chapter 1, some attribute that specifically relates to their problem, and that's how he identifies himself. In each one of these, he picks out an attribute, a characteristic of himself presented in chapter 1, and refers to himself from that particular attribute because that attribute is the one that deals with the problem that he's writing them about. All right? So he says, I am the first and the last, which was dead and am alive. What's that about? Turn back to chapter 1, verse 8. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the ending. Now, Alpha is the first letter in the Greek alphabet. Omega is the last letter. And look in verse 18. I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. And I have the keys. I have control, ownership of hell and death. What does a person who is going through suffering need to know the most? Does he need to know about judgment? Does he need to know about tithing? Does he need to know about Christian art? No. He needs to know that Jesus, who's allowing him to be in the middle of this mess, is not only the author, but the finisher of our faith. Jesus suffered too. Jesus lived and hurt too. But he says, as I came out on the other side, I want you to know the one that's writing you, the one that's encouraging you, the one that's helping you and understanding you in this suffering is the one who himself has suffered. And how did I come through suffering? Victoriously. There is victory. There's resurrection. There's death and there's life. There's Alpha and Omega. There's beginning and end. And that's what that church needed to know more than anything, that there was victory. There was tomorrow morning. There was sunrise. There was hope. But the valley they were in and the futility they were suffering was not the end of it. The one who was writing them, sustaining them, encouraging, was the one who himself was the very God of suffering, going through the valley and coming out in victory on the other side. So that's why he refers to himself as the one who was not only the first, but the last, the beginner and the consummator. This thing's going to have an end. It'll have consummation. It'll have victory. He was not only dead, but he is alive. Not only was the Alpha, he is the Omega. Not only was the beginning, is the ending. Not only was alive and dead, but now is alive forevermore. Not only experienced sin, death, hell, and the grave, but who has the keys over them and is in charge of them and controls them, and they don't control him. So they don't control the believer. And that's the thing that that church needed to hear. And that's the thing we need to hear and know and believe the most when we suffer. That is that we go through the valley, but we don't die in the valley. We go in the tomb on Saturday, but we come out on Sunday morning. We're down in the pit in Genesis, but we're on a throne with him in Revelation. That's what they needed to hear. Oh, incidentally, because I didn't mention this last week, what was it from the revelation of himself in chapter 1 that he used to say to the first church, Ephesus church? Well, let's look at it. Go back to chapter 2, verse 1. Unto the angel of the church at Ephesus, write, these things saith he that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, who walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. The thing that he referred to there was not about suffering. It was about presence. It was not about eternal victory. It was about not abandoning them. You see, Jesus is going to show that these seven churches are in trouble. They've got problems. And here's a church that was so bad, he said, if you don't straighten up, I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. They were in big time trouble. But he said, I am the one who is in the midst of the churches, who walks in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. And Revelation 1:20 showed us that was the churches. I uphold the stars, the pastors, and the angel, the messenger of the church, in my right hand. So the thing this church needed to hear was that in the midst of judgment, there is hope. The God who is about to judge them if they don't straighten up is the God who has no intention of abandoning his churches. And I want you to hear this. Even though God may judge a church and write Ichabod over a church, he doesn't abandon his churches. He's not giving up on his churches. There are black sheep and stray children and discards and problems and false prophets. But it's still through the ministry of his pastors and through the fellowship of his churches that he does his work. He will not separate himself from his bride. That was the message to the first church. And so the second church, who needed to know encouragement in the midst of suffering, their problem was not coldness and impending judgment. Their problem was suffering for things they hadn't done any, they hadn't had no cause to suffer for. They hadn't done anything wrong. He says to them, I'm the one who brings victory and consummates and brings you out of the valley on the mountaintop on the other side. That'll be an interesting study as we go along and see when he introduces each of these letters and says that this letter is from so-and-so, but he will always identify himself, that so-and-so, that writer, by a characteristic in the first vision of chapter 1, which relates to their particular need in the letters in chapters 2 and 3. All right. Now, the Ephesus church began in great revival. Do you remember 2 weeks ago when we saw in the book of Acts, remember, that everybody in Asia was being saved? Everybody was hearing, everybody was aware. And whether this is intended to be a historical footnote or whether simply to be hyperbole that says, man, just everybody's getting converted, I do not know. But I do know this, it was in the heat of great revival that the Ephesus church, which died, was born. It was in the heat of suffering and persecution that the Smyrna church, which lived, was born. So how then did the Smyrna church begin? Well, strangely, we know absolutely nothing from the Bible, from Roman history, or from church history about how the Smyrna church began. We know a lot how it ended. Don't know anything about how it began. We do know, however, much about her pastor. I'm going to give you a name that you're going to instantly remember from your study of the church fathers. Roman secular history tells us that the pastor of the church at Smyrna, their pastor was Polycarp. Polycarp, one of the famous church fathers. A man who was their pastor. He was a writer. He was known widely. And he was martyred for his faith. We know very much about him. We know exactly about his ministry. We know that he pastored this church through the height of its suffering for 60 years. We know that he preached a total of 83 years. All of this from Roman history. And we know that Polycarp, the famed church father, the noted pastor of Smyrna, died, burned alive by martyrdom on February 23rd, year 155 AD. So we do know much about him. Now the name Smyrna, this is most interesting, is a Greek word from which we get the word myrrh. Myrrh. What do you remember about myrrh? Well, the first thing you remember about myrrh is in the Bible, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We find myrrh in the Bible 4 times, all related to some form of suffering. Smyrna means to be crushed, means to be hurt, it means to suffer. And myrrh, from which the word comes, always means and is related to suffering. When Jesus Christ was born, they brought gold and frankincense, and myrrh. Gold speaks of his deity, the eternality of the Father. The frankincense, the mist, the sweet fragrance of the Holy Spirit. The myrrh of the ministry of Jesus Christ in his suffering on the cross. Now, do you remember when Jesus Christ was crucified, that they brought him vinegar mixed with gall, and one account says, and myrrh. That's the next time. There are 4 times in the New Testament the word myrrh is used. Here in Smyrna for the suffering church. One at his birth, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And one at his death where they gave him wine, a sour red wine we call vinegar, gall, and myrrh together. And it was a painkiller. It was an anesthetic. And when he tasted what it was, he spit it out and wouldn't take it. Then we remember on the first day of the week when the women came to the tomb to embalm him, they brought 100 pounds of spikenard and what? Myrrh. So in his birth, in his death, and in his entombment, there in the tomb from whence he was resurrected, we see the suffering reality and symbolism of myrrh all through his life. Now the myrrh tree was a very, very hard tree that gave no fragrance. However, when you stomped the myrrh bud and crushed it and beat it and pounded it, it had the sweetest fragrance known in the world. And the more you stomped it, the more you crushed it, the more you beat it, the more you pounded and stepped on and hurt it, the sweeter the fragrance became. And so myrrh was used as a perfume. In the remember when they anointed Jesus' brow with Mary with the sweet, Mary Magdalene with the sweet, expensive oil at the door. They say, no, this is kept for the day of his burial. You didn't bring flowers in those days. You brought perfume. And so the myrrh speaks, first of all, of the at the birth of Jesus. It speaks to us at the death of Jesus as a witness, as an anesthetic, and at his burial as an embalming fluid. The sweetness of his birth was the sweetness, those swaddling clothes, that he would be entombed and then crucified and entombed. And so it was a fragrance, a perfume, it was embalming fluid, and it was used as an anesthetic. So at his birth, life, and entombment, just part of his resurrection, we see myrrh all through his life. What do those things say to you about Jesus? That the Son of Man came to suffer. And the only other time you find the word myrrh is when a little church that is suffering as did their Lord, listen, and for their Lord, was called a myrrh church, a suffering church, a Smyrna church. All right. We're keeping our little granddaughter 2 or 3 days, little Brittany. She's a little over 2. And anytime anything goes wrong, she bursts out in tears and starts calling, Mommy, Mommy, Mommy. Just the same way the little church, the most normal reaction in the world to injury for the believer is to call Mommy or to call Daddy. And this little church was near to the heart of Jesus, because their suffering drove them instantly to Jesus. And it exploded with life. It became a powerful church, a great church by suffering. It does drive us to our Lord. Now, the devil finally smartened up. After 312 years, minus 33, of trying to destroy the church by persecuting the church and finding the church exploding with life and getting bigger and stronger, finally Satan got smart, and in 312 AD, he married the church. He moved in with the church, and the Roman Empire under Constantine and the church merged. Now you have from then all through the Dark Ages a secular Christian church. Smyrna may be the oldest city in the world. Think of that. Smyrna exists today. Now you know that these cities and these names change, and these countries. Rhodesia is now Zimbabwe. We've been in Rhodesia when it was Rhodesia, been back when it was Zimbabwe. And so we know that cities change their names, and nations change their names, and countries. Well, this little city is today perhaps the oldest city in the world, now a very large city. Smyrna today is 300,000 approximate population and a very burgeoning and booming city. It is in Turkey. And you can find it on your map tonight in the encyclopedia under the name Esamar. Esamar, E-S-A-M-A-R. Smyrna of old is Esamar today. If you remember any of your philosophy studies in college, school or college, you may remember that Smyrna was the birthplace of Homer, the philosopher. It was the crown city of Asia. Now, in the Roman Empire, they had 6 what they called free cities. In all the Roman Empire, there were only 6 cities that were called free cities. And that meant that they were so strong and so loyal and so prosperous and so well run that they didn't need to be governed by the Roman Empire. They could govern themselves and were allowed to do so. They were the ultimate of loyalist Roman citizens, a pagan government, which gave homage to Caesar. Now that's where this little church lived. So you've got to get the background to understand the seriousness of their commitment to Christ that was born out of their suffering. Not only was the Roman government tyrannical and powerful and pagan, But it was also extremely militaristic and mean and harsh. They ruled with a tight iron. The Roman judicial system of law is still the basis of much of Western civilization's governing process today. It was iron-like, it was strong, and yet there were six cities in the entire Roman Empire world that were so loyal and so good that they said, "We trust you to govern yourselves." They were free Roman cities. Free, F-R-E-E. That's not a three with a can't talk, it's free. And of these six cities, now get this, the Roman Empire decided that they would make, first of all, the Caesars were gods. They were said to be gods. But they went so far in their paganism that they decided to deify, to incarnate in a deity, not only their emperors as gods, but the entire Roman Empire itself. And so when they set out to deify the whole Roman Empire as a god, they called her Dia Roma, the god of Rome. God Rome, the Rome god, God Rome. And she was a goddess. And where did they decide to build the temple? That was the temple that was for the worship of the goddess of the incarnation of the entire Roman Empire. The temple Dia Roma was built in the heart of Rome, of Smyrna. And they had to build and pastor and run and operate a little church right down the street. Now, why was that difficult? It was difficult because of this. These people lived under the shadow of a culture that said, "Caesar is Lord." You had to say it, you had to testify to it, you had to believe it, you had to practice it, you had to serve it. You had to say, "Caesar is Lord, Caesar is God." And if there's anywhere in the world that Roman patriotism ran high, it was in Smyrna, the capital of the six free cities that had allowed the temple of the Dia Roma, that embodied the whole Roman Empire as a god. And they built a little church right down the street. And they said to them what they said to every citizen of Smyrna and every citizen of the Roman Empire: "Say Caesar is Lord." You said it in the classroom. You said it at prayer meeting. You said it on the way to Sunday school. You said it on a military campaign. You said it anywhere and everywhere you went. You said it at a ball game. You said it when you saw your friends in the street corner. You'd holler out your chariot window, "Caesar's Lord." All but the folks at Smyrna. They said, "No, Jesus is Lord." And it was that obstinance which caused such ostracization and persecution and hatred from their friends and their government that caused them for 200 years to be crushed. But out of that crushing of that tree, that myrrh tree, bud, there came a fragrance that was so sweet in the nostrils of Jesus. It was the only church he didn't condemn and correct, but that he commended and honored. Now let's go on for a moment. Verse 9. He says, "I know thy works." He said, the first thing I want you to know is, I know your works. Now the word "know" here, and there are four times this happens in this expression, in these next two verses. Two Greek meanings for each of these words in all four times, and the difference is very significant. "I know thy works." What do you want more than anything else from somebody when you're suffering? You just want them to know. You just want to know that they know, that they understand. No flowers, no words, no gifts. No philosophy, nothing can do as much for a suffering person as just an identity, a relationship, an empathy of spirit that says, "I know, I know." Therefore, Jesus chose one of two Greek words, which he could have chosen, that was very significant. The first no means to be aware of. There's a Greek word for no, which says, yeah, I know what the score was last night. We won 6-3. I know the score. Doesn't mean I was there. Doesn't mean I played the game. Doesn't mean I experienced the thrill and the emotion and the sorrow of the moment and the frustration and then the final victory. It means I just heard about it. That's not the K-N-O-W he uses here. It is not a no by hearsay. It is not a no by observation. It is a no by experience. When Jesus says, I know what you're suffering, it's different than when some of us say, I know what you're going through. Jesus says, hey, look at me. Remember me? Remember rejection? Remember my friends? Remember betrayal? Remember my loneliness? Remember the cross? Remember the abandonment? Hey, this is me you're talking about. I know by experience what you're going through. The second place you find an important thing that happens about two possible words is the word works. The first word, works, that could have been used here means condition. I just know what kind of shape you're in. But this word that he chose for works means I know how things really are. We meet people all up and down the aisles of the church. How are you doing? Fine, how are you? And they're just about to die. They're carrying a burden on the inside that's about to break their heart. They come with a smile and they do their best and they smile. We say, oh, I know, but we don't really know. It is to know their works, to really understand how things are. That's what the word works means. Then he goes on to say, and your tribulation,